Our reading today will be from Acts chapter 17, verses 22 through 28. Paul then stood up in the meeting of the Areopagus and said, "People of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To the unknown God.' So you are ignorant of the very thing you worship. And this is what I am going to proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of the heaven and earth and does not live in temples built by human hands. And he is not served by human hands as he is needed anything. Rather, he himself gives everyone life and breath and everything else. For one man he made all the nations that they should inhabit the whole earth. And he marked out their appointed times in history and the boundaries of their lands. God did this so that they would seek him, perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from any one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. As some of your own poets have said, we are his offsprings." That's the end of our reading. You may be seated.
Thanks, Raul. It was about a year and a half ago that I first made my way to Africa. We have another one of those flags back there for Uganda. I was going to train pastors for a couple weeks. The flights and everything that kind of got together ended up with me flying into Uganda about like at 10:30 at night. And by the time I get through immigration, it's like 11:30, and I stumble out of the airport, and there's my little taxi going to my little hostel that I'm staying in. We drive through there. There's not a ton of lights going on around. It's a pretty dark place at night, little lights here and there. So really, the next morning, I wake up in Africa, like just to see it for the first time. I didn't really get to see it the night before. And so then Pastor Robert comes to pick me up. I say goodbye at the hostel, and we drive all the way through the main capital city into the smaller cities and all the way out into the villages out in the area. And by that evening then, I am in the little village of Bukeka, ready to participate in a crusade. Which is where they're kind of sharing their faith. This is a picture that's going on there. Hard to maybe kind of make it all out. There is a crowd kind of in the foreground, and I'm really trying to look across the street. Then there's a street or road going through the middle of town, and then it's hard to see. You can maybe pick out a couple. There's some soldiers there with automatic weapons, and then another crowd on the other side of the street. So the setup is, there is on this side, it's a little bit more off to your left, a stage area, and then all the Christians are gathered over there. There's the road with the army soldiers in the middle with their automatic weapons, and then the Muslims are on the other side. It's in a highly Muslim community. They were very cognizant of tensions and things over that. So that was the setting that I got to dive into to give my first sermon in Africa. I gave a really good American sermon. It had a lot of good American humor in it. It approached things as would be appropriate in America with a sweet and gentle presentation of a God of tenderness, a God who doesn't reject but gathers in all the frail and the weak and all those kinds of things. It would have been a great message anywhere in America. And it bombed. Hard. Pastor Robert is very gracious. I think he was looking in the next 2 weeks and saying, like, "Oh my gosh, what have we brought here?" But had really honest conversation that evening where I'm like, okay, what world am I in? Because I don't even know, and I'm not sure how to get across to these people. So then I had another sermon the very next day where I got to speak to a bunch of high school kids, and it was 300% better. It was really solid, because even in that short amount of time, I began to get my African feet around me. I began to listen to other people around me and realize that what works in America doesn't work there. They don't want this gentleness. They don't have political correctness like we do, where you can't get too into someone's face. What I preached on the second day was, here's a 2x4. Let me smack you between your eyes with it. That's what works in Africa. Like, there's a God of power. It's all about kind of in your face. It's these rigorous challenges that would not at all work here, right? The congregation would leave. You know, it wouldn't work anywhere, but that's what works there, right? And it's not a matter of saying one culture is better than the other. It's just realizing that you should preach the right sermon for the place that you are. right? Makes sense. And so we find that with Paul too. And we've got a couple of his sermons going through Acts. Most of the ones so far, we've seen Paul coming to a synagogue with a bunch of Jewish people that have had this background in the Old Testament that know about a coming Messiah. And so he's like, hey, let's open up your scrolls and point to all the ways out of the Old Testament that it said Jesus was going to come. And now you've got that foundation. He is the Messiah. Here's what we know about him, right? It works great in that setting. But here in Athens, we find him. He'd already gone to the synagogue earlier in chapter 17. Now he's gone to Mars Hill, the Areopagus, this high area in there where they gather as philosophers. And they have no Jewish background at all. So Paul then approaches them in a way that fits their context. He says, you're not like me. You're not like the other people I preached to you, so I'm giving a different sermon. The sermon that we see in this section of Acts is radically different than the rest of the ones Paul preaches. Different vocabulary, different framework, different organizational structure. In almost every way, it's a different presentation because he knows it's a different way of approaching things. So our goal then is to learn out of that. How do we speak when things around us are different, right? When we're in a different culture, on a mission kind of field, and we need to accomplish those things. And what I need you to understand before we dive into that is that there has never been a culture, never, that has been fully God-honoring. You can pick any culture you want. Whatever you know out of your own personal history, you go back to the 1950s in America, you can go back to the time of David in the Old Testament, or anywhere you want in all of human history. There has never been a culture that is fully God-honoring. Right? Every single one has places that the biblical message challenges and corrects that culture. That is always true. So there's never a culture that the church can just lay back and rest. Right? There's always work for the church to do in addressing issues in that culture. But likewise, there's never been a culture which has been completely devoid of the impact of God. Right? So you cannot find a culture where God isn't at all and he hasn't brought things about. Right? And so that's what we see Paul doing. He says, hey, I already know there's a culture where God has been involved here. Even though it doesn't have all the trappings I'm used to, the Old Testament, the Messiah, all the prophecies, all those kinds of things. He's like, God's already been here. So I can start with what God has done. Right? This is a core theological truth that we have before we get to the practical things that will follow, which is that God always precedes you. This is a universal truth about relationships, and all the things we'll look at apply to them. Okay, so I'm just for a moment going to take a little side trip so you can see where else it fits into your own life, and then we'll come back, because Paul's essence here and what we really need the most is that there is a need for people to hear about Jesus Christ. So that's where Paul is, and we'll come back to that. But I will tell you the same things that Paul walks through, that he first again begins by knowing God gets there first, right? God is already present. I can build off the things that God has done. He says, I looked around, I found an altar to this unknown God. I know God's already here. You're hungering after him. You're curious, right? This fits there. The next thing he does is says, what are the common values that we have? He says, I can see that you are religious. Hey, that's good news. I'm religious too. I can see you know these truths about God. I also know those things. What do we have in common to start with? And then we find him choosing a different language to use, the different words that he uses, different all along the way as he communicates. Those simple component parts of saying God is here first, what are the values that we share, and how do I find a language that communicates, apply in every relationship, right? So just as a side note, briefly, we live in a culture right now that is ripped apart politically. If we're ever going to find a place of agreement, we have to first say, hey, when I look at someone across the political aisle, I recognize God is there first. They are not completely lost. God is at work in their heart, and if I look, I can find good. I should start looking. We next say, where do I have common values? Instead of accentuating the differences, how do I find what we share together? How do I use language that communicates to where you are? That works on political differences. It works on marital differences. If you want the solid place to start when you're facing difficulty in marriage, stop focusing on what doesn't work. Stop focusing on what you disagree on and pause for a moment and say, what do we have in common? What do we share? What do we both value? And when you're done with that, you can look at the differences. They'll still be there. They won't run away. But you set a different foundation, right? There's a lot we share in common. Same thing in families. If you have to correct your child, if all you do is begin from the point of difference, no, stop. God's at work in this child. As frustrated as I am by them right now, as whatever else it might be, God's in there. What do we value together that I can share? And how do I find language that communicates effectively to them? So this applies in any relationship, right? I want you to see that. You can import it wherever you need to after that. We're going to dive back in, though, and look specifically at when we look at how do we communicate across the culture. And that becomes valuable for us because we've mentioned a lot recently, this month we're studying kind of together, this understanding that culture around us has shifted significantly. In the time of Constantine, around 300 AD, we saw this merging of Christianity and kingdom and politics, right, into one that we gave the term Christendom. It was not because it was dumb, but because it was kingdom and Christianity smushed together, right? So you have the kingdom, you have the political realm smushed together. That has, at least for us, from a European roots and into America, been our cultural tradition for well nigh on 1,700 years. So it's pretty deep, it's pretty significant, and it is withering or fading away or being eroded right now. So that we live in a world in which being a Christian doesn't give you any benefit culturally. Being a Christian isn't beneficial for you. There's no extra power that we carry politically, or at least it's withering significantly as we look around us, right? So we see those things changing. In Christendom, when you have Christianity and the kingdom together, there's not a whole lot of external fears because you're a part of the whole status quo. So what happens there is instead of focusing on commonalities, you focus on differences. This is the root of our denominations. People that have sat down together and said, you look at baptism differently than I do. Let me accentuate the difference that it is. Draw a really clear, bold line there so you're on that side and I'm on this side. And when you have Christendom with Christianity and the politics together, you can focus more on what makes us different. Wouldn't it be radical to see a Lutheran and an Episcopal sit down together, and before they dug into what they didn't have in common, they said, first, let's begin with everything that we agree on and value together. And then maybe 7.5 months later, we'll look at the few things we disagree, but we'll have this foundation. This love for Christ and all these things that fill us out of Scripture that will allow us to approach it differently. Right, so in Christendom, we've emphasized the differences, and that's where things have gone. Paul is charting a very different course. It says, let's begin by finding what it is that we have in common. So Paul goes into this place. Now, when he goes to Athens, in the midst of a pagan city filled with philosophy that is absolutely opposed to his Jewish roots, can he find anything of difference to point out? Yeah, he's got a good list. He'll get to it later on, but he begins with a humble heart, and look at what he says in verse 23. He says, I walked around, and I looked carefully at your objects of worship. And I didn't look at them to find out how wicked they were, and how wrong they were, and how happy I am to destroy them. I looked at them because I know that even in your idols, in the things that have captured your heart, I believe I can find references to God. So I'm going to look for something that I can honor in that. Because I know God got there first. Right? We recognize theologically, this is a huge underpinning for us. So as a church, if you don't understand it, we need to get there together because this is how we move, right? We understand that we are not leading Jesus anywhere. Right? What do we do with Jesus? We follow him. You can only follow what's already there. Right? So we have eyes to say, can I see Jesus at work? Then I'm going to follow him. That's our whole mode of operation. That's all the Bible gives us, right? But we know that he made it there first. Paul says that too. He says, I'm not the first person to get to Athens. Jesus is. So if I slow down and look carefully, I can find the things to honor in you. I can find the things to respect in you. I can find the good aspects. Not that I can't find other stuff, but I'm starting there. And I'm building the bridge and building the place of commonality. So Paul says, here are the things about you that are true, that are right, that are good. Let me begin from that point to say, God has been at work in you. Isn't this wonderful, the things that we share? Right? So this is all theological. This isn't even something Paul does necessarily other than looking. God got there first. So when we recognize that, that transforms all that we do, right? We become followers looking for him and trying to follow along after him. It's a blessed way of living. It's way less difficult and challenging and hard than trying to make the way on your own. So Paul begins by saying, let me find something to honor as I look closely at your life as an individual, at your culture, whatever else it is, I find those things. And then Paul says, out of that, I'm going to find some values that we share. Once again, are there any values that Paul disagrees with in that Greek culture? Yes. Many, hundreds, right? As you look in the culture around you, if you're a biblical Christian, can you see values in the culture around that you disagree with? Yeah. And once again, because the church in Christendom has been so good at differentiating and accentuating differences, if you ask the culture, they will most likely know many of those differences. Because one thing the church has done very well has been to say, we're not like you in all of these ways. Often that comes off as hate, or the culture interprets it that way. I'm not worried about that. But the reality is the culture says, we already know the things you don't like about us. All right, that's a difficult way to start. Like on your first date, let me just begin by saying the things I don't like about you. Let's see how the relationship goes after that. Not recommended if you're trying out that, you know, that first dating experience, right? Let's begin by what I do like. We'll figure the rest out as we go. Right, so the church has got that flipped around, which is one of the reasons why it's under a lot of pressure right now, because we've managed to tell the culture, we think you're ugly in these ways. And yet haven't found the ability to say, here's where we find you beautiful. And that's always what woos people, right? So let's look at a couple of those modern values that we have in the culture around us, right? The culture around us values social justice. Does the church? Oh, yeah, right? That's up our alley. We ought to be celebrating that. How are we not proclaiming that from the top of the mountains? Like, you care about justice for all people in the world, right? For the least and the lowest. You know what? We do too. That's so cool. We share that together. Let's go work on that together. Let's find that common place, right? Do you value all people equally? That's so amazing because the church does too. In fact, if you go back far enough in human history, do you want to know the roots of the idea that all men, women, humanity are equal in value? We actually find that so significant, we put the symbol of that in the front of our sanctuary. So every day we gather in worship, we can look at what makes us equal. It is the cross and the promise of salvation afterward that is the first place humanity ever said every person is exactly equal. Everywhere else you find that written in all of humanity has sprung out of this philosophical foundation. So you like equality? Guess what? We like it more. We'd love to help you find the roots of it and connect to that. And we're all on board that every person is equally of value, regardless of how they act or feel or whatever else, right? We share that heart with you. Why is the church not known for this? Why can't we begin by what we have in common like Paul did? I see you're religious. I see you like equality. We love it too, right? This is where we are, right? Personal experience is the height in our culture, right? You can't argue with personal experience. It trumps all other authorities. It doesn't matter what ancient texts have to say. It doesn't matter about all those things. And right, we have problems with that because we have a text that's pretty old that we like. But do we have any connection as a church to personal experience? Have you read the Bible recently? What is most of the Bible? personal experience. It's not God saying you need to look for a bush that's on fire and doesn't go out. It's God saying, here is the unique experience of one man a long time ago that will then reveal the nature of God out of his own personal experience. We love personal experience. Our whole faith is founded on a book chock full of it. So you want to tell your personal story? Awesome. I want to share mine with you. We call it His Stories in here. You can call it whatever else you want, right? It's testimony about that. I'd love to share you some other personal experiences and hear what you think about that. Right, God already gave us what we need. We don't have to throw this away. It doesn't matter how old they are. When you share those stories, they resonate with hearts. That's why we come back again and again to them. Because even though some of the trappings are ancient, the characters and the emotions and the connections are absolutely modern. So God has given us this great gift to say, even if the culture around you is different than what you grew up with, He's like, I'm prepared, I'm ready. I gave you a book that's a perfect access to that, right? So in this culture, too, there is this value of questioning or challenging authority. And at first blush, that seems kind of problematic for the church because we have a history of being tied into authority, right? Because we were Christendom smushed together. And that means the church had authority everywhere else and didn't want to be questioned. And for most of the last 1,000-plus years, the church has tried to say, don't question authority because we are the authority. Is that the biblical story? Not really. There's times in the Bible where the church has authority or where followers of God do. There's more times where they don't. And the voice of the church is there to question authority when it goes astray. We have hidden away in the Old Testament this rich resource called the prophets. And they're written in poetry, and that makes it kind of difficult for us and weird language. But it is, in my belief, the books of the Bible for our culture in this day. Because it speaks profoundly about social justice. It speaks eloquently and powerfully about equality even before the cross comes around. It speaks deeply of personal experience, and it will challenge in bold and courageous ways authority when it goes astray, when it's corrupt, when it's greedy, when it's self-centered, right? There is a heart of courage that is rooted in those books that we need to rediscover and find. And so all of this, we could go on a lot more. There'll be more stuff in the next week or so, a chance for you to respond back to that on some of those values. I simply want you to see that even though the world around us has changed, there are common values. Are there values that we disagree on? Yes, tons. We're not ignoring them. We're not saying we won't get to them. But if we expect to have an impact in our culture, we had better find something we find beautiful about it. We need to say it honestly. We need to say it with truth. And we need to walk alongside those things. Because if all you can see is ugliness, you won't get a second date. Right? So when Paul then finds those values and says, we share these things in common, the last thing he does is says, I need to adjust my language to match yours. I mentioned last week, and we'll dig into it a little bit more today, that Story, our youth director, had gone out and done about 46 interviews of individuals age 18 through 70 in local malls around over the last couple weeks. A lot of the resources of that are going to be posted online, so you can look and see the whole stats from that, responses to a whole bunch of different questions, as well as direct quotes from people. It's really fascinating stuff to dig into, so I'll invite you to do that. I want to look at one part of that specifically today. She asked a question about language, and she said, here are some words that are connected to faith, and all she asks is, are you familiar with the word? So I want to be clear. She's not asking and saying, do you understand it? Do you have a correct understanding of it? Nor can you use it appropriately in a sentence. She just merely says, does the word sound familiar to you? Right? It's about the lowest bar you can possibly say. Like, I am cognizant that that word exists in the English language. Right? So at the higher end of the spectrum, we have the New Testament. So 79% of the people that she interviewed in our culture around us, this time, this place, said we are familiar with the words New Testament, which means one out of five aren't even familiar with that. It drops off fast after that. Sin comes in at 58%. Which is a little challenging. That's such a deep word for us, such a common word for us. And 2 out of 5 people that you engage with in the community around you aren't even familiar. It doesn't mean whether they like the word or not or understand it appropriately or not. They don't even have it in their vocabulary. So all this sin, guilt stuff that is at the cornerstone of so much we do, for at least 40% of people, isn't even on the radar, right? It doesn't even exist there. Salvation drops down to 20%. 4 out of 5 people around us don't even connect to that word. And it's in our church's name. So we had, when there was Christendom, we had this agreement with the culture around us that it would learn our language. And so for 1,000+ years, you could use words like this, and everyone around, even if they didn't go to church, was required to know what sin was. Not legally, but culturally. You couldn't exist without hearing the basic biblical story somehow, knowing there's an Old and a New Testament, knowing some of those basic component parts. All those words were out there. They were cultural words. They were used everywhere. There's no agreement between the culture and Christianity anymore. And I don't think we can expect that they're suddenly going to learn those things. Paul didn't show up in Athens and say, hey, before I can share with you about Jesus, I need to give you a primer on the Old Testament and Jewish history and all these prophecies and who the Messiah is. And once I'm done with that, then we'll finally have a common language. No, Paul said, I just need to get you to Jesus. There's 10,000 different avenues to get to him. I can use words all over the place. I'm not limited by the ones that occur there. I'll find the ones you already have in your vocabulary to make it easier for you, right? Gospel drops down to 15%. Words like lost and like discipleship, crater somewhere around 9%. Out of the respondents that story got, 40% said they were Christians. So she's not just talking to non-Christians, she just took a sample, anyone who would talk to her. 40% of the people that responded all the way along there are Christians. Claim that themselves. So out of all that 40%, like 75% don't even know what discipleship is. It's not even a familiar word for them. Right? So the language has radically changed. A story poked around a little bit on the idea of denominations too. Had a list of those things and said, hey, give me your feedback, positive, negative. Have you heard of these things? What's going on with that? 95% either said, I have not heard of it, or I have an absolutely neutral, vacant feeling, right? Maybe I've heard of the word Presbyterian or Methodist or, yes, Lutheran, but I have nothing to attach to it, or I've never heard of it at all. 95%. And exactly 0% said, I have any yearning after a specific denomination. Nobody that she talked to said, there's one denomination above others that I like, that I prefer, that I am drawn to. So as we think about being effective in communicating in the culture in those years to come, all of this language stuff is important for us. To understand that if anyone's going to change, it's got to be us that learns a new way of communicating and new terminology and new words. None of that means we're not Lutheran. I'm not saying that. It doesn't mean we're changing theology. None of that. Paul didn't change theology. He just changed language. He said, I can communicate the theology in many different ways. Simple verbiage, different verbiage, all over the place. Doesn't matter to me. Like, I can get you to the right theology. Let me find the language you already know, you already understand, to make that transition possible. So as we look ahead as a church in these next couple months and figuring out where are we going, what does the future look like, all these things filter in for us, right? All these things become important. What's interesting is that Paul, as he comes to the end of his message, finally comes back to Jesus. So one more thing from the survey I'll share with you. Paul ends his whole sermon there by saying, hey, all of this is kind of proven to you because there was this man who died and then was resurrected again. And their response was much like the response we have. A lot of them were like, that's just crazy talk. I'm done. I'm out. And then there are others that are like, man, I want to hear more. All right, but for Paul, the end of the thing wasn't, I need to have messianic talk, I need to talk about Jewish prophecies, I need to quote Scripture. He does not quote Scripture. What he does quote is a poet, right, which is like their local pop songs. He said, I was listening to your radio, and I heard this on there, I heard this poet, and he quoted that. Can you imagine a sermon where Scripture isn't quoted and pop songs are? Because that's what Paul just did. And he said, I don't even care about that because I can get you the right theology. I can get you to Jesus by using your pop songs. It works. Because God's everywhere. He's already integrated in there. If I look far enough, I'll find the connecting points. Paul says, I'm not worried about that. My focus is Jesus. We do not exist here so that somehow we can convince and communicate to our community the essence of the word gospel or the essence of the word sin. Or the essence of the word Lutheran. It doesn't matter if the future generation knows any of those words. It matters that they know the Word of God made flesh. That's it. And when we become flexible enough in the other stuff and narrow-minded enough on that to say that is the only thing we're after, then we find a way to communicate in a new culture around us. Paul's experience was much like mine in Uganda. He was transiting through somewhere, right? He said, hey, I'm in Athens for a little while, so let me understand your culture, change the way I'm speaking, effectively communicate there, and then I'll go back to my normal way, right? I went to Uganda for 2 weeks. I'm like, I need to learn Africa as well as I can in 2 weeks. So that I'm here, I can be effective for you. And then when I go back, I didn't bring Africa back with me. Like, I left it there, packaged up nicely. Now I know how to talk in America. I can figure that out, right? We're not in the same boat because we're not passing through. Right? We are replanted in Athens or in Uganda, and we're there to stay. This is where God has placed us, in a culture that doesn't understand all the stuff that we assumed it did before. Where many of the values don't match, and we got to find some that do, where the language is absolutely different. This is where God has put us. And what it means for us is that there will be change. That's a scary word, not a really happy one. We like things to stay the same as much as possible. I get that. No one's really hungering after that. But the reality is it's there. And it can bring about a lot of fear and a lot of uncertainty. What I want you to see from today is that we don't have to be afraid. Not because I have the answers, not because we're good enough together, but for the same reason that Paul wasn't when he walked in there, because God got here first. And Jesus showed up in Portland 2017 well before any of the rest of us did. And he's ready. And he chose each of you to be in this place. Not so that you could go out and fail. He said, as hard as those changes may be, as difficult as they might be, God says, I put you there because I've got a plan in place. And I've got connecting points and I've got you prepared. And it might challenge you. It might stretch you. But God says, we can get to a way that we can make church function in this culture. There has never been a culture that God has not been able to plant church in. And I will promise you that Portland 2017 will not be the one that will finally undermine him. So take heart. Be encouraged. The future will be different than the past, but the same God is walking through it with us. Will you pray with me? God, if I were left to choose my time and my place in the world, I probably would pick one that was less chaotic than the current one. I'm not super excited about all the transitions and uncertainty about the future. I don't gel with that. But the reality is I didn't pick the time that I would live, and I did not pick the place that I would be. You did. And you did that for all of us, God. And so we come then with humility and recognize that you have a reason why we are where we are at this certain time. And we believe that you are prepared. God, we ask that you would give us courage to walk into change, a flexibility to make mistakes along the way, and a wisdom, God, to learn a way to communicate the truths that we have learned in a new way. With new language, God, give us eyes that are open to see where we already have connecting points, where there are values that are shared, that we can begin to start from a place of common ground. And God, we ask that in the years to come, your church would be deeply rooted in Portland and in this place to the glory of your name.